Τα τα κατά ιοίτικε.
For me, when I ingest certain medicinal plants, certain gifts from Gaia, gifts from Gaia, gifts from Gaia, the first thing that happens is a change in my perception of light, a change in luminosity.
My observation that the plant world is really speaking to humans, that this little species, human beings, has an inordinate amount of power on the planetary interspecies community nature level, and that we've gone crazy with it, and we're as a species suffering, and so are many, many others. And I feel that the plant world is reaching out and reminding us and calling to us and enchanting us in all different ways. The psychoactive medicines are one of those ways. In order to use these medicines, you have to be rebel enough against a taboo to look at the taboo. And the whole nature of a taboo is that it's an area of culture where we're told, don't look there, it's not good to even look there. That's what a taboo is. It's not just something that's forbidden, it's something you're not supposed to look at.
Years as these super technologies have been developed in the West, the smashing of atoms, the invention of radio, television, computers, immunology, so forth and so on, data has been arriving about the practices of Aboriginal cultures all over the planet, that they dissolve ordinary realities, ordinary cultural values, through an interaction, a symbiosis, a relationship to local plants that perturb brain chemistry. And in this domain of perturbed brain chemistry, the cultural operating system is wiped clean. And something older, even for these people, something older, more vitalistic, more in touch with the animal soul, replaces it, replaces the cultural operating system, something not determined by history and geography, but something writ in the language of the flesh itself. This is who you are. This is true nakedness. You are not naked when you take off your clothes. You still wear your religious assumptions, your prejudices, your fears, your illusions, your delusions. When you shed the cultural operating system, then, essentially, you stand naked before the inspection of your own psyche. Desmond Morris called it the naked ape. And it's from that position, a position outside the cultural operating system, that we can begin to ask real questions about what does it mean to be human, what kind of circumstance are we caught in, and what kind of structures, if any, can we put in place to assuage the pain and accentuate the glory and the wonder that lurks waiting for us in this very narrow slice of time between the birth canal and the yawning grave? In other words, we have to return to first premises. Thank you.
for me, when I ingest certain medicinal plants, certain gifts from Gaia, the first thing that happens is a change in my perception of light, a change in luminosity.
That visual shift is one of the real clues to where consciousness actually locates itself in the body, and with those kind of plants,
yes,
which are basically intended for all life forms. They affect all life forms very similarly. And, I mean, other plants get, their nervous systems are very similar to ours. So when a plant releases psychotropic chemicals,
yes,
into the ecosystem, and other plants take it in, they experience the same kind of expansion in perception as we do, because all life forms on this planet are basically built around similar templates, and the molecules that they use, their nervous systems are very similar. So, but it is fascinating that one of the amazing things that immediately happens, mm-hmm, then is that shift in the way the eyes see. The things begin to take on a certain luminosity, but their edges are also not quite as sharp. They're softened,
right,
too, as if they've got this very delicate light coming up from outside of them and that is onto them. And, you know, that touches into a thing Henry Thoreau said in a lot of his work. He would say, you know, nature cannot be perceived directly. It must be seen with the unworn sides of the eye. I mean,
yeah.
I love that, the unworn sides of the eye.
Beautiful.
Because we look so much through pinpointed, focused vision, we miss what happens when we shift to a more peripheral focus, and that tends to happen when consciousness shifts from brain to region of the heart, and we begin to, our sensory perception is infused with a kind of empathic feeling, and we begin to perceive things that can't be seen with the linear mind. And one of the very first determinants of that shift in state is luminosity of vision. The very first part of it is really coming to your senses, to literally begin to notice through your sensory mediums the world around you, to truly begin to hear. As Henry David Thoreau said, you must walk so that your mind does not perspire. That's one of my favorite lines. So brilliantly elegant. And to literally let these sense impressions from the world flow in without preconception as to what they mean. And then to begin to ask yourself, wherever you go, in every landscape that you walk through, how does this feel? And to allow that feeling experience to emerge. And in the process, when people do that, they're always drawn in a field to one plant more than all of the others. There would be this one plant that captures their attention. You know, I've taught this for maybe 15 years now with, you know, thousands of different people, and it's remarkable to see the similarity of experience that they go through. And you go to that plant that draws you, and then you begin to spend time with it, just like any life form that you're attracted to. And what happens initially in the beginning is, as you open yourself to the plant, there'll be a series of impressions or feelings or thoughts or images that will occur spontaneously of themselves, and it takes a while to calibrate that process. It's just like learning how to reason, like you do in school when you're learning to read or write, or mathematics. It's just a skill that we've been trained out of, but extremely natural to human beings. And so you let those images come up, whatever they might be. Like you'll be sitting with a plant, and all of a sudden you might have this image of This one young student had an image of this plant that came to her. Was they saw a baby in a cradle board, and you know, she's like, "Well, I don't know what that means." And it turns out that that particular plant was used by the indigenous people in that area for diaper rash. So that's how it kind of starts. But as you work more deeply with it, like Goethe, the great German poet, was really into it. Masanobu Fukuoka, the Japanese farmer, and you know, even Barbara McClintock, that won the Nobel Prize. You know, she said, "I never went any place that the corn did not first tell me to go. To understand my method, you have to understand, you must have a feeling for the organism." So some of her contemporaries have said, "Well, you know, her research is great, I just hate the mysticism." And she's like, "Well, you don't understand, the mysticism is the essence of the thing. It's not mysticism, but a living experience." And so you begin with that small kernel that emerges, and you begin working with the plant more and more, with the ecosystem or whatever large body you're working with, and you follow that thread of feeling wherever it goes. These kind of images and insights begin to deepen, and what happens after a while is this thing that Goethe called the pregnant point, where you're burst through into kind of this point of stillness where you understand these incredible complexities in the plant itself or in the ecosystem that you're working with, that the, you know, it's kind of an axis of reality. You might pick up knowledge of the chemical actions that are in the plant, or the ecosystem function of the plant, or the medicinal actions of the plant. There's so many different things that can come depending upon your orientation and focus. And those things become the kernel of true knowledge gathered directly from the heart of the world. Like indigenous people said, you know, the plants themselves told us their uses as medicine. This was not trial and error process. And when you've got, you know, I've looked at hundreds of different tribal traditions and interviews with every one of them that I could find from the, you know, 17th through the early 20th century, they all described it in very similar ways. So there is this way of gathering information from the world without using reductionistic thinking as a medium, and that's the thing that is of most interest. I mean, because it feels so good to be once more interwoven with the life web of the earth, to re-inhabit inner being with the world. It's a lot more fun to feel good, to feel oneself surrounded by living intelligences. I mean, one of the great benefits of this way of being is that you never feel alone anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, it's always interesting. I love hearing NASA scientists talk about looking for intelligent life on other planets. I mean, those guys can't even find intelligent life on this planet. How are they going to find it someplace else? Impossible. Everybody feels the damage to our planet, and it has a feeling to it. You know, I've worked for many years as a psychotherapist and an herbalist. People don't come to me to think better. They come to feel better. And all of us are struggling with this despair of feeling because we feel the impacts of what's happening. And that's the most important thing, not realizing that we're exceeding our carrying capacity for the earth. But you can literally see it in the way a stand of trees is treated. We know there's something wrong.
most plants, if not all, are psychoactive plants. It's just some of them, because we get so habituated to being stupid, we need to be hit over the head with the cosmic 2x4 to wake up a little bit. But after a while, as your sensibilities increase in sensitivity and you begin to take these plants, yarrow is a very psychoactive plant, but at a subtle level. So it changes function. Skunk cabbage is a psychoactive plant, but at a subtle level. So many more plants are psychoactive than they know. Yeah.
People say that what we're all seeking is a meaning for life. I don't think that's what we're really seeking. I think what we're seeking is an experience of being alive. There is an animal consciousness, and we share all of these things. You eat certain foods, and the bile knows whether there's something there for it to go to work on. I mean, this whole thing is consciousness. I begin to feel more and more that the whole world is conscious. Certainly the vegetable world is conscious. And when you live in the woods, as I did as a kid, you can see all these different consciousnesses relating to themselves. Now, it is a part of the sort of Cartesian mode to think of consciousness as being something peculiar to the head, that this is the organ originating consciousness. It isn't. It's an organ that inflects consciousness to a certain direction, a certain set of purposes. But there's a whole consciousness here in the body. And the whole living world is informed by consciousness. I have a feeling that consciousness and energy are the same thing somehow. Where you really see energy, there is consciousness.
Sometimes they do things to us that we find quite pleasurable. And so we have an incentive to repeat that experience. So I think that these psychoactive chemicals in some way are a co-evolutionary mechanism, a way that, you know, and here's where we get away from science and into speculation, but a co-evolutionary mechanism by which the community of species, or at least the community of sentient species, has evolved to talk to this primate.
Wow, this is really a moving, not necessarily that it's moving, that's easy, but that there's also some deep meaning there for you. But the meaning is not right on the surface. Because the ego is the object of the transformation. It's the thing that's supposed to be transformed. And yet the ego has to somehow understand the dream or the synchronicity experience. What?
It's really interesting. Plants seem to work a lot, and they act as maintainers of the homeodynamics of ecosystems, and they're constantly monitoring everything that's going on in their eco-range, and they begin to produce chemicals that they release into the ecosystem, either through their stomata or through the mycelial network, and those chemicals actually help maintain the functioning and health of everything in their eco-range. And so if there's a plant on one side of the range that is ill, they'll actually make the chemicals that will go through the mycelial network and begin to help that particular plant. They'll do it for animals within their eco range, anything like that. So you see, natives would often say, indigenous people would say, oh, before the day before you go to collect the plants, tell the plant what you need it to do so that when you get there, the plant will be strong in its medicine. And it turns out that under the impact of a need, a plant will begin shifting its phytochemical production, and within 24 to 48 hours, it'll be that whatever it's shifting to will be at its peak. So one of the stories I like most is about chimpanzees, how they know over 100 different plants to use for healing themselves. And if they have, let's say, a certain kind of intestinal parasite, they will get up in the morning and they won't eat anything. They'll go off by themselves and wander through the forest until they find the exact plant that they need to heal themselves. And they'll sit down by it and hold a living leaf of the plant in their mouth and just sit there. And part of what happens is their body then is able to tell how strong that plant is for helping them. If it doesn't feel right, they'll go and do it to the next one until they found it. But the plant also can analyze the saliva of any animal that touches it like that, and it knows what it is and begins shifting its phytochemistry in response. Who's an amazing guy, lives in Virginia, a real amazing guy. He does this, he talks about this. He says, well, you know, I can kind of get that. He says, that makes sense. These plants and animals grew up together over thousands and thousands of years. And he said, the one that bothers me, though, is the plants that were taken to Africa after the New World was discovered. And they've been there only about 400 years. And the baboons know exactly how to use them for medicine. He said, that's when my brain begins to shut down, because it basically says there's some mechanism of understanding that's active all the time that animals have to understand the uses of plant medicines. And we apparently have it as well. And Jim Duke says, I got too many degrees. Now, my medicine teacher, he can do it, but I feel a little twitchy about it.
It's all alive. It's all connected. It's all intelligent. It's all relatives.
Plants are the greatest chemists that the earth has ever known. I mean, that's all they do all the time is, you know, turn sunlight into an air into these amazing chemicals. And for them, a chemical is a word. Like, I'm making words now with sound waves, but they make words out of chemicals, and they create the chemicals that they exchange with each other in response to information, our input, just like we get. There's something that happens in their environment. They analyze what that is, and then they will release a chemical in response. And so there's a lot of reasons why that in under what circumstances and in what forms they'll do it. You know, they if another plant that's hooked into that mycelial network becomes ill or isn't getting sufficient nutrient of a certain kind, then other plants will begin making it, and scientists or researchers radioactively labeled a bunch of stuff and watched it. They could actually track it go from one plant to another and that needed it. So this kind of thing is really intriguing. Of course, indigenous peoples have known about it forever. Nevertheless, it's really fascinating to see this and how sophisticated it is. Like, for instance, in if spider mites begin feeding on a plant, a bean plant, for instance, the plant can actually, as the mite eats the leaf, the plant can analyze and figure out exactly what kind of spider mite it is by analyzing its saliva. And then it will create a chemical that it will release as an aromatic through its stomata, which are little mouth-like openings on the underside of the leaves, that will call the predator of exactly that spider mite and no other. And if it's a different spider mite, it'll call a different predator. And it's, you know, you have to understand they're releasing a chemical that is very, very complex in its structure, but is incredibly specific. And it kind of, stuff like that plays havoc with our assumptions about intelligence in plants for a lot of things. But even more than that, plants will begin creating certain medicines for members of the community that are ill, for chimpanzees or for human beings or for whatever it is that needs some kind of healing. And indigenous peoples would talk about that and say, oh, in North America, for instance, if you pray to your plants before you go to harvest them, then when you get there and you pick them, their medicine will be much stronger and you won't be ashamed in your medicine. And that kind of sophistication, which I trace in the book in a massive amount of detail about these very subtle exchanges of chemical communication that's very sophisticated among plants.
And then I promise you, you'll dream a different story. Called again, I promise you, you'll dream a different story.
Carry the wildness inside of us. There's no way about that. The people I meet at herbal gatherings have done something completely unique. They've eaten the wild redeemer. Once upon a time, a plant saved their life, and once that happens, everything changes. You begin to carry this thing inside of you that then touches other people, and it keeps this certain kind of tradition alive. It's a counterweight in many ways to the technological culture that we have now, but we keep the old wisdom alive. And as that old culture begins to disintegrate more and more, we've reached the end of its potential. We've been consuming ecological capital rather than living off of ecological interest. And that system is beginning to disintegrate. Nothing's gonna stop it. But what happens is, for some reason, thousands upon thousands of people all around the world are finding herbal medicines and they're wanting to train in them. I ask them why all the time. They say, I don't know. Something just called me to it. I felt like I should. What other kind of profession do you ever hear that from? Like, they spend thousands of dollars and years of training to train in a profession they can't legally practice, that their society doesn't recognize. some deep part of us, of the human species, knows we're going to need this knowledge before too long. We carry a certain lineage, and as antibiotics begin to fail more and more, we will step into that place to minister to the human community like herbalists have always done.
The brain.
The brain. I mean, they're so into the brain, you know. And but the fascinating thing is, it turns out consciousness really isn't limited to organ. Consciousness is a thing that comes into being. It's a nonlinear expression of a biological oscillator. Once all of the parts of the body self-organize, this thing comes into being that's more than the sum of the parts. And it can't be found in any of the parts that are being studied, but nevertheless, it's there. So it turns out it can actually locate to any part of the body that it wants, and it can actually permanently locate to the three primary biological oscillators in the body, either the brain, the heart, or the GI tract. And in our culture, the real fascinating thing about what's called the Enlightenment that happened in Europe,
yes,
was that that's when, for the first time, people began to relocate consciousness to the brain rather than in the region of the chest somewhere. And that had phenomenal impacts on, you know, the studies that have been done on that are really fascinating. When consciousness moves up into the brain, certain things just can't be perceived.
Correct.
It moves back down into the heart. Many things can be perceived that, you know, and that's why people would say, you know, like Thoreau would say, a man has not seen a thing who has not felt it.
Yes.
And that feeling aspect, I mean, it's still, within the American culture, one of the things that's been extremely irritating to me is that people are taught to not trust their feelings, to really not trust their body. In a lot of ways, we've been trained to lose our trust in the physical.
Yes.
And that means also that the physical has any intelligence or awareness of its own. So we don't trust that our bodies have intelligence or awareness. We don't trust that our feelings are reliable guides to things. No, or that we can feel that our hearts have the ability to think, that they have perceptual and cognitive capacities. And so what happens is we're cut off from our feelings, and people apologize for them way too much in our culture. And one of the first, most revolutionary parts of reclamation of the self is to decide that how I feel matters. It's really what makes me different than a computer, if I want to make it a very, very, very simplistic kind of statement. Why all of a sudden we thought that, you know, not like that Spock on Star Trek was the pinnacle of human expression, that Data, you know, that if only we could be like Data, you know. So the real beautiful thing about Thomas Harris's creation of Hannibal Lecter was he took it one step further. I mean, we have the progression from Sherlock Holmes, who was the first archetypal character like that ever in literary history, to Spock, Data, to Hannibal Lecter, who can only remain human by eating the insides of others. Because he has no inside, he's just a mind.
Wow, I hadn't thought about it that way, yeah.
One of the brilliant things about the creation of that character in literature, because it expresses the bankruptcy of that archetype as being the dominant orientation.
Right, Right.
People that are in the head, they become empty on the inside, and they try to fill those hole, that hole in them. No matter how much Prozac they pour in there, the thing is never going to work, because what's missing is the reclamation of their capacity to feel. That is what connects us to our ground of being, to the world around us. Discover so much only because we have forgotten so much. The thing is that so many of us have been working to reclaim this capacity of perception and relation with the wildness of the world. I mean, Goethe was very strongly involved in it. He hated reductionist Newtonian physics and approaches, and he was one of the most famous people in the world, the first real great megastar in a sense. And he could make very little impact. And nevertheless, over the centuries, more and more people have been pressing for this, the recognition of the aliveness of the world. And Lovelock's articulation of Gaia is only the most recent form of that. And it spread so strongly because within everybody, it reverberated in a deep place where we knew that was true. And nevertheless, this emerging awareness and perception of things confront so heavily such an entrenched paradigm in which many, many millions of people make their living. So, you know, I mean, James Hillman has a great line. He says, as soon as science convinced us that nature was dead, they could begin their autopsy in earnest.
Wow.
Isn't that a great line? But see, that's one of the most crucial points of it, is that only if we believe the world is dead, that Earth is dead, that we will allow that kind of autopsy, dissection that occurs every day around all of us, to go on unrelentingly, to change the environmental framework which is causing so much damage on the planet. Laws are not going to make that much difference. Yeah, we can make a million laws, but what fundamentally has to shift is our interior experience of the aliveness of the world. And to anybody that tries to do that is guilty of the most fundamental heresy of which they can be guilty. And the scientists don't want it, the corporations don't want it, the religious fundamentalists don't want it. So we're bucking a huge tide here. Nevertheless, just as plants break through the concrete in our cities and our sidewalks, this living belief is breaking through the concrete in all of us. And it keeps emerging over and over and over again in greater and greater numbers until this wildness, you know, what Sartre, you know, the existential irritant of the planet, you know, he's like, green paws will come out and cover the cities. Yeah, they will, but it's nothing to be afraid of. It's actually a lot more fun. We'll be right back.
the best things can't be told because they transcend thought. The second best are misunderstood because those are the thoughts that are supposed to refer to that which can't be thought about, you know, and one gets stuck with the thoughts. The third best are what we talk about, you see. And a myth is that field of reference, metaphors referring to what is absolutely transcendent.
Indigenous people said, you know, the plants themselves told us their uses as medicine. This was not trial and error process.
And that to assuage our cosmic loneliness, we should build ever larger radio telescopes and million-channel signal analyzers and sift the radio noise coming from the stars. And eventually, if a signal is found, an immense philosophical turning point will have occurred, and we will then place ourselves in the context of the cosmos. This is actually a red herring kind of argument, because outside of the highly technical Western societies that have evolved in the last 300 years, people have been talking to the other since man began. Angels, demons, fairies, sprites, elves, all of this is as phenomenologically a part of human experience as, we'll say, birds of paradise, which I'm sure none of you have ever had anything to do with, but believe inflexibly that such creatures exist because it is allowed by the experts that they exist. What psilocybin focuses as a problem that these other hallucinogens do not is it allows a dialogue with the other that is full of give and take. In other words, there are entities in the hallucinogenic world that psilocybin and DMT and a few other not well known or widely distributed plant hallucinogens induce. I think it was William Blake who said, the truth cannot be told so as to be understood without being believed. And this is the kind of information that is coming through the psilocybin experience. It is information which you have to believe it. You have to believe it because it has this ring of authenticity. It is the logos. It is the word somehow. And what is being said is that our alienation, and this word is interesting, alienation. Our alienation from ourselves has caused us to set up a number of straw men that are keeping us from building actually a mature model of how the universe really works. The content of the dialogue with the other is a content that indicates that man's horizons are infinitely bright, that death is in fact, as Thomas Vaughan put it, the body is the placenta of the soul. And this fact has not yet been assimilated because it runs counter to Western reductionist, materialist empiricism. But this idea that the body is placenta to the soul is not an object of faith or a dogma. It's a program for activity. The activity that it implies should be undertaken is a familiarization with the soul. And the soul has been banned from Western thinking about the self for nigh on 400 years, at least in leading circles.
Mm-hmm.
For me, when I ingest certain medicinal plants, certain gifts from Gaia, the first thing that happens is a change in my perception of light, a change in luminosity.
So interactive with the world for such a long time that, you know, I've tended to go to the natural world for healing, to work with the plants. And so my work with the plants then brings me deeper into nature, but also then there's this healing part. It's kind of like it goes back and forth from one side to the other, back and forth. And, you know, what's interesting to me about beginning work with plant medicine, though, over 20 years ago now, was that, you know, I knew that we should work to heal the earth, but it was the first time I'd had the experience of the earth healing me. And that experience is different. It's one of the reasons I love to go to large herbal conferences, because there I find something I've experienced no place else, and that is those people have eaten the wild redeemer. They've gone into nature and they have taken this wild thing that grows of its own accord into their mouth, and it has healed their disease. And in that moment, something enters inside them that is not inside anybody that uses pharmaceuticals as their primary healthcare system. The wildness of the world has healed the individual person, and in that moment they begin to be the servant of this thing much greater than themselves. It's a remarkable experience, and to see the similarity in people that have experienced that from different cultures. Oh, like the International Herbal Symposium, so that occurs south of Boston every 2 years at Wheaton College. I mean, there's herbalists from every continent on earth practically that come and talk about it, and it doesn't matter their language or their culture. There's this experience of going to the wildness of the world and finding healing that's just one of the most profound experiences that I've ever known. This belief that everything is reduced down to these basic building blocks of matter is really scientism. It's not science. And, you know, that's a good way of thinking. Nevertheless, in school, we're constantly taught that there's some fundamental reality that has more value when we work with these tiny bits of matter, and that if you can't see it under a microscope, it doesn't really exist. So that linear thinking, that there's this cause and effect thing, that everything is reduced down to some mechanical part, is very different than when you're in a culture where they accept the fact that there's intelligence in nature. They're not trying to prove it because they've already accepted it as so. Then the big question becomes, what do you do with it? How do you interact with it? What are your responsibilities to it? What are its responsibilities to you? How does a human being fit in place with this kind of a thing? And so instead of spending all of this time on does love matter, or, you know, or do feelings matter or anything like that, we're already looking at how do we live a full life working with the invisibles that are a part of life. And Western science linear thinking has a very difficult time with invisibles because they're so difficult to grasp in so many different ways. And reductionists, by reducing things down like that, they're able to escape the terrible subtleties of the universe. But in fact, life is not really a mystery to be solved, but a reality to experience, to live. And there's a lot more to it than we're trained in. So, you know, so as people go on and study more and more, there's a number of scientists who are not doing scientism, but they're doing real science, and they begin to notice that ecosystems and even human organs have these remarkable properties of nonlinearity, that you have an input into the system and you can't predict the outcome, like that the tiny, tiny changes, like for instance, as I talked of in Lost Language of Plants, if you drop a chemical one part per trillion into an ecosystem, which most scientists say, well, you know, that can't have any impacts, it begins to change the whole thing. And so you get into the area of study known as chaos theory or nonlinearity, mm-hmm. where you realize that you're dealing with something that's more than the sum of the parts. And you get behaviors that can't be predicted from any study of the parts. And it's that thing more than the sum of the parts that you can feel. You can see its impact, but you can't find it under a microscope. It's impossible.
Jugs of wine get drunk. Let the truth be known tonight. Don't go let yourself hide. Go and sing to the mountain. Go and sing to the moon. Go and sing to just about everything. 'Cause everything is you. Listen to the rhythm of your heart play like a drum. Listen to the night call, singing songs from all around. Go and sing to the mountain. Go and sing to the moon. Go and sing to just about everything. 'Cause everything is you. Let your voice go, let it pierce through your soul. And let your voice go, let it pierce through your soul. We'll be right back. burn tonight. Let the jugs of wine get drunk. Let the truth be known tonight. Don't go let yourself hide. Go and sing to the mountain. Go and sing to the moon. Go and sing to just about everything. 'Cause everything is you.
Because it feels so good to be once more interwoven with the life web of the earth, to re-inhabit inner being with the world.